Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, thank you so much for tuning in for a little bit of your day as we continue to go through the big old monster box of baseball cards. Getting near the end here as we go through the sets of 1993. Today we're looking at an interesting set because it was actually a pretty nice set in terms of just design, but it wasn't really a great set, not a very memorable set. And even in 1993, it was getting jettisoned for more premium sets. We're talking about 93 Score. Like I said, a set that was actually pretty decent looking, but even the Pinnacle Company, which owned Score, the Score brand, even in 1993, they weren't putting much of an effort, as you will see, especially when talking about our specific random pull here. Greg Maddux, card number 576. Again, we're in the echelon of players that there's only so much more you can say. Baseball Hall of Famer, 23-year career, phenomenal pitcher, to put it lightly. I mean, 355 wins. That's not so bad. Numerous Cy Young Awards, four consecutive Cy Young Awards. Numerous All-Star appearances. We'll talk a little bit about Greg Maddux. Also, the chances of getting a 300-game winning pitcher. We've had back-to-back podcasts with 300-game winners. Greg Maddux here, Nolan Ryan in the last one. And it's a stat that may actually be harder to come by, hitting 300 wins. That used to be automatic for Hall of Fame inclusion. You know, much like once you hit 3,000 hits, once you hit 400 home runs, and even that's not automatic anymore. When you got 300 wins or 3,000 strikeouts, that was instant. There was no doubt you were going to get into Cooperstown. And that is something that, because of the specialization of pitching staffs, you're going to see less and less of, I think. And it actually kind of goes back to a conversation we had several podcasts ago, actually more than several, it's actually a few months ago, 86 Tops with Jack Morris, you know, complete games. Jack Morris had an insane number of complete games in his career. And that's something that really goes by the wayside now with specialization of pitching staffs and bullpen artists. So we'll talk a little bit about the 300-win conundrum, and we'll discuss Greg Maddux's excellent career as well and the 1993 Score set after we touch briefly on what you're talking about at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Again, your home 24/7 for any baseball card conversations. And a little light this week, but that's all right, because a lot of the interaction we've gotten is actually on our survey. So let me start with the survey. The survey is available. If you go to Wax and Gum Stains, go through the Twitter feed, you'll see tweets for it. And in fact, if you're already following us there, you'll see tweets for it again over the next few days. I think I'm going to close the poll probably on Wednesday, maybe Thursday. So if you haven't taken it yet, please do. It's only 10 questions. It takes literally 2 minutes. This is not an SAT test by any stretch of the imagination. After all, I wrote it, so why should I make the questions that difficult? We just want to take the temperature of our audience and just see what you like, what you don't like about the podcast, and more importantly, where you want it to go from here, because as I mentioned, the Monster Box, we run out of cards and sets really in just a couple of weeks here. And the plan moving forward is we go through 1993 sets. We will do a few different podcasts on minor league cards, logo-free cards, team sets. So we did that per a request of a fan. I thought that was actually very interesting. So we'll do two or three of those. But then the question is, where do we go from there? Now, I will talk about the final results of the poll in our podcast on Friday, but just a couple of things that I've gleaned from some of the responses coming in. I would say almost overwhelming response in where we go next is that we go back to the 1950s through the collection that I have. Do random pulls. You know, I have a collection of cards from 1954 to 1980. We started with 81 in this one. So while I don't have a whole lot of cards from the 50s, I do have some. so we can talk about the card designs, the players featured on them. And I have a lot more cards throughout the 1960s and definitely throughout the 70s. I got a ton from the 1970s. So it's a lot easier to do a random pull there. So there's not necessarily a monster box. It's a big fat binder. So that's probably where we'll go. From the big old monster box to the big fat binder of cards. So we'll go through that. And I have a hunch that's where we're going to go, unless you say otherwise. So again, that's all part of the survey. Also, you know, we do have some of the questions in there that are commentary questions. So if you want to provide us some more details on what you like, what you don't like, what you want more of, what we should be doing next, then make sure that you fill out those little comment boxes. And I did see one comment from a listener who said, talk more about the more obscure players and less the star players. So I actually wanted to address that now. In case you didn't hear in a previous podcast, again, this whole project started with a monster box of cards in a closet. So you've got roughly 5,000 cards. Most of them are from 1981 through 1987. Now, the junk wax era, which most people will say is from 88 to 93 or 94, I used to have roughly 25,000 cards from that era. So a lot of the cards from 88 through 93, which is the peak time of when I collected, I didn't really collect much in 94 and going forwards, but from 88 to 93, much like every other collector at this time, I probably had an 800 card box full of 88 Fleer and an 800 count card box of 88 Tops and an 800 count card box of 89 Donruss. You see what I'm getting at? You know, I used to have boxes upon boxes upon boxes, but about 10, 12 years ago, I got tired of dragging those damn things around, and it's very hard to try to just sell a box of cards from the junk wax era. It just is, unless it is a wax box, an unopened wax box, or a vending box. If it's a hand-collated collection of cards, even if there are good cards in there, trust me, it is very difficult to get even a few dollars for them. And especially if you try to sell them on eBay, the shipping alone will kill you, because depending on your shipping method, it's going to cost you $12, $15 just to get one box of cards out there. And trust me, nobody is willing to pay $12 to $15 for a lot of 89 Donruss. As much as that may surprise you, that's just the situation. It's just not going to happen. So I found a card shop that took my cards. They paid a dollar per thousand, and I dumped a lot of the cards from the junk wax era, got some card supplies back so I could take care of the cards that were from that era that were of value or that were a little older that I wanted to protect. So what that means is the cards that I didn't dump from the junk wax era are basically the star cards, the star players, some semi-star players, and rookie cards. So if you look back at our archive on audioboom.com, and you can do that anytime, just go to audioboom.com, type in Wax Ecstatic in the search window, and you'll see all of our 60-plus episodes before this one. You'll notice that from 81 through 88, for the most part, it's mostly, I mean, when I say a random pull, it's a real random pull, because I'm pulling from a stack of 200, 300 cards. And sometimes you'll get a pretty decent player like Reggie Jackson for 87 Tops, Steve Henderson for 86 Fleer. Who else did we have? Von Hayes, who had a, you know, decent career. Dave Kingman, you know, they were 83 Donruss and 83 Fleer respectively. And then sometimes you get the really random guys. Guys like Larry Cox for 81 Fleer, Tim Stoddard, 81 Tops, Ed Romero, 84 Fleer. Who was another one? Doug Lohman, that's one of my favorite ones, from 85 Donruss. And as a broadcaster who gets to talk to athletes on a regular basis, I'll be honest with you, getting the story from a lesser known or a lesser appreciated player, in my opinion, is far more entertaining for me, not just the broadcaster, but the fan, because these guys have stories that you may not know much about. So I love getting those stories from the more obscure players. The thing is, from the cards from 88 through 93, because I got rid of a lot of those obscure player cards, we're left with star players. So there's nothing wrong with talking about Greg Maddux as we will today. You know, Nolan Ryan last time. We've had recent podcasts about Frank Thomas. We've also had, you know, Jim Tomei, Don Mattingly. So some pretty well-known players. And I'm sure over the next two or three podcasts as we wrap up 1993, it's going to be a well-known player or well-known rookie from that time. But as we go back, you know, especially if we go back to the 1950s and start working through my collection from there, you will get some more random players. But again, while the occasional star player is exciting to look back on and reminisce on, I find the random players, you know, the lesser known players, they have the great stories. And again, you know, some of the examples that I put out there, Larry Cox, you know, his story and how he died at such a young age, that actually really determined the direction of this podcast. You know, I had a completely different idea as to how we were going to talk about these players on the podcast. But when I did the research and the background on his story, I was so stunned, you know, with how his life ended, that this was more than just a quote unquote lesser known player. I mean, this was a human being. This was a guy who had, you know, a career, a life, a family, which he left tragically way, way, way too young. And you know, while playing basketball with his son, which is just, as a father, that is just tough to take. So, you know, the Larry Cox story from episode two is one of my favorites. Cause again, it really kind of did the direction on how we talked about players on the show. But also, you know, I mentioned Ed Romero. You know, here's a utility infielder who, you know, his greatest claim to fame now as a scout for the Boston Red Sox, he found Yoan Moncada, who is now, of course, with the Chicago White Sox after the Chris Sale trade of a few months ago. But, you know, that's a phenomenal story. And actually, you know what? It isn't Ed Romero who's the scout. It's his son, Ed Jr., who found Moncada. So there's an interesting story there. And Doug Loman is one of my favorites, too, because Doug Loman was one of the rated rookies from the 85 Donruss set, a notable flameout in terms of Major League Baseball prospects. In fact, after 1985, he really didn't have much left in the tank in pro ball. He's a preacher now. So how cool is that, that you've got, you know, a former rated rookie that we pull at random here, and now he's delivering the message of God for a church somewhere. So that long-winded response, for those who are concerned about, you know, geez, why are we taking up so much time talking about a Greg Maddux or a Nolan Ryan or a Frank Thomas, that's because right now, that's all I got. You know, I don't have too many common cards from 88 to 93, and that's a good thing. I got rid of them. But we will definitely, especially if we go back to the 1950s and work our way up through the 1980 top set, there will be some more random, truly random players. And because of that, we'll have some perhaps lesser known or lesser appreciated players, but some very interesting stories along the way. And also with our feedback from our poll, I have seen some very interesting suggestions, some things that we may not do on a regular basis, but that we may filter in throughout future podcasts. And I appreciate all the feedback because it's been very interesting. It's also been very positive, too. And again, I'll go through the complete findings in our next podcast on Friday. But your two cents are very much valued. So please do, if you haven't already, take the poll. Look for it on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed over the next few days, as we will close it out before the end of the week. And I'll take the best suggestions, put them on a to-do list. And as we chart the course of the podcast over pretty much the summer, then I think we'll certainly put some of these into action. And again, it's been a mostly positive response. And I appreciate that as well. Doing this podcast, coming up with it, it was just on a whim. It was just a side project. It still is a side project. I've got a day job to do. I've got a family to feed. And this is, something that as of the moment, I'm not drawing any money off of. And I'm certainly not looking to get rich off podcasting. Very few people do. But it's fun to talk about this topic. It's fun to get the interaction from fans. It's been phenomenal to see how much this podcast has grown. And I thank you for doing that, for spreading the word, for telling people about the Twitter feed. A lot of people have found us that way. And again, through iTunes and through Audio Boom, I appreciate you, again, getting the word out there. And we have a lot of fun just looking back at some of these sets and players. You know, this was just something where it wasn't just a whim, but I kind of assumed that we should do the show this certain way. And so far, most of you like it. So that's a good thing. So please do take part in that poll. If you've already done it, please don't take it a second time. I would just like for, one poll submission per listener, please. I would greatly appreciate that. All right. Now, as for the last podcast we did, which was on 93 Fleer Ultra, and Nolan Ryan was our random poll. Ben Adams with a great answer to the podcast. And I didn't mention this in the podcast because I actually did bring it up when we were talking about Robin Ventura in a previous podcast. That was so awesome when he busted Ventura in the face. Yeah, there's a reason why I called Nolan Ryan the ultimate baseball badass from that generation. Because when Nolan Ryan clocked Robin Ventura, let's see, Ryan was, how old was he? He would have been 46, I think. Maybe 47. And we all know the story. We've all seen the video. It's hilarious. And I'm sure Robin Ventura still doesn't like to talk about that rather iffy moment for him where he decided to charge the big hulking Texan who was throwing a little inside at Arlington Stadium, the old Arlington Stadium, too. Now, some comments about the set itself. Manny Randhawa, who is a listener of our show, writer for MLB.com. Thank you so much for listening to us, Manny. Loved this set. Loved in capital letters, too. And this was a set, like I said in the podcast, even though 93 Ultra was very similar to 92 Ultra with just a few tweaks. It's just a great set, great style, great design, great selection of cards. And even though it is from the quote unquote junk wax era, there's still a lot of value to this in terms of just a quality set. And you can, again, for $20, $30, you can probably get a couple of wax boxes and just rip into it and probably get the complete set, or mostly the complete set. Mark Klatsy, or Mark Klatt, you don't have your full name here, but Mark K, listening to us in Brisbane, Australia. Thank you so much for doing so. Halfway around the planet, giving us some kudos here. If you're into 90s baseball cards as much as me, these podcasts will bring back some memories. Well, thank you so much, Mark. And again, even though we're going to be exiting the 90s relatively soon, I hope you and everybody that you've brought in with your kind comments will keep on listening as we go back on, probably again to the 1950s and moving forward, unless our fans say otherwise pretty soon. So again, Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter feed. Join us anytime to not only talk about the podcast, but also about any of the players that we talk about, any of the sets that we talk about, or just anything about the hobby in general. It's very interesting to see day by day and week by week where the conversation goes. It goes all over the map sometimes, but that's what makes it even more entertaining. Now, as for something that wasn't very entertaining, the 1993 score set, that is the set that we are looking at now. And again, in 1993, we had so many sets that came out and different variations of sets. And of course, as I say, subsets to subsets, but also you had brands branching out. They kind of had subsets to the main set, and Score was a victim of that. The Score brand was part of the Pinnacle company, and in 1993, Pinnacle pretty much gave up on Score, which was kind of a travesty because Score, when it came out in 1988, and I encourage you to listen to our podcast on 88 Score, which, you know, featured Spanky McFarland of the Pittsburgh Pirates. You know, Score was actually ahead of the curve on a lot of baseball card innovations. Yes, even before Upper Deck. And Upper Deck gets most of the credit in 1989, but Score had the much better quality photography, good card stock, full color photos on the back of the card, tamper resistant packaging. You know, they had that soft plastic as opposed to the wax. They didn't put in, you know, bubble gum or anything that would destroy the cards. So Score was ahead of the curve, but Score was also one of the brands that just kind of got left at the curb, not the curve, but the curb, as the industry changed so much. And as I've said numerous times on this podcast, really, with Upper Deck setting the bar high and everybody catching up to Upper Deck by 1992, Score was the one exception, as Pinnacle kept producing the Score brand. But if you go back and listen to our previous podcast, even starting with 91 Score, while 91 Score was very contemporary, the 92 Score card was rather plain. It was an okay card, but it was one that you just didn't go out of your way to buy back then, and you certainly wouldn't do it now. And that's the same thing here. And one of the reasons why you probably didn't go out of your way to buy 93 Score was not only because of the design and the lack of really good cards, but also Pinnacle was really cutting back on the promotional push behind these cards. In fact, Pinnacle had the Pinnacle brand, which was starting to gain some steam, but also they released the Score Select brand. And Select was, of course, their more premium version, kind of what Top Stadium Club was to Tops or what Ultra was to Fleer. Score decided to take the main brand and branch off of it. So I've used numerous times the comparison of the baseball card industry to General Motors, where, you know, when Upper Deck came around, Upper Deck was the Cadillac, and, you know, the other brands were lesser brands, you know, the Chevrolets and the Buicks and the Pontiacs. Well, by 92, everybody then became Cadillac. Well, by 1993, you not only had each and every car company trying to be the Cadillac that Upper Deck was, well, now they were trying to be their own General Motors. So, you know, the Pinnacle Select was Pinnacle's Cadillac. The Pinnacle brand, you could say, was like, you know, Buick, one of the higher echelon General Motors. And then Score very quickly became the Chevy Chevette, basically, of the Pinnacle tree of cards. So if you didn't buy a lot of 93 Score then, you're probably not buying a whole lot now, with the exception of if you're in the hunt for a Derek Jeter rookie card. And that's card number 489 in the set. If you get the card graded, then there is certainly some value. And I've seen some graded cards, I'm still stuck on the rated rookie thing. I've seen some graded cards for the 93 Score Derek Jeter going anywhere from, you know, $20 to $25 to $80. So there is some value, and that's one of the few things that has kept the 93 Score set going, and that's pretty much it. And you can see why when you look at our random card here. Now, we have Greg Maddux here, a Hall of Famer in his own right, card number 576. You look at the front of the card, and Score was still bucking the trend that all the other car companies were going to. And by 93, most everybody had eliminated, if not the entire white border, then most of the white border. You know, Leaf Studio had no border to it. Top Stadium Club didn't have a border to it. Upper Deck slowly eating away at their border. Well, 93 Score was still going out with the prototypical baseball card, so you have a whole lot of white on the border, but still a lot of space left for the photograph. And here's a great action shot of Maddux in his delivery with the Chicago Cubs. And at the bottom, in very tiny letters, you have Greg Maddux's name in the left-hand column, if you will, going up from bottom to top in very tiny letters. You have the team that he played for, the Chicago Cubs. You have the position in the lower left-hand corner. And in the upper right-hand corner, you have the Score logo, and that's it. So you give 93 Score an A for simplicity. We like simple. We like clean. Very business-like. However, it's very boring when you compare it to all the other sets in 1993. And again, I kind of look back to the Donruss sets of 1992 and 93. Some very sharp and clean looks, but when you look at the Ultras and the stadium clubs and the studios and certainly Upper Deck, very boring, very blah. So it's simple, yes, but it's also, you can see there wasn't a whole lot of effort put into the design of this card. And when you factor in, there wasn't a whole lot of effort put into the marketing of the card because Pinnacle was too busy pushing the Select brand as opposed to the core Score brand. Then you get, you know, what is a very blah card. Now we flip the card over and you have the hallmarks of the typical scorecard. And this is something, regardless of the design of the card, I have always liked with Score. Yes, even with the debacle that was the 89 Score set, I've always liked the back of the Score cards from 88 through 93. First of all, you have the player's name at the very top. You have the team logo in the upper left-hand corner. Love team logos. Good mugshot here of Greg Maddux in his Cubs uni on the right side. You have, again, going from top to bottom now in the right-hand column, you have the team name and the card number in the upper right-hand corner. Now, all you have to do is take a quick look. If you put these pictures side by side, and we conveniently do that for you on our Twitter feed and also on the Audio Boom landing page, you will see that basically the back of the card, in terms of a template, is essentially a mirror image of the front of the card. It's basically inverted. So you have the team name on the left-hand column, position lower left-hand corner, player's name at the bottom. Well, now the player's name is at the top. The team name is on the right side, and in the upper right-hand corner is the card number. So again, not a whole lot of thought went into this. Except somebody going, hey, if we flip this template that way, look, guys, look what I just did. That's a winner, Phil. Let's do it. So that's essentially what Score did there. Now, all kidding aside, you have the career stats of Greg Maddux, and then you have the complete scouting report for the player. And I've always liked the really in-depth report here. Now, I don't think it's as in-depth as some of the earlier Score brands, but still it's pretty good here. So let's actually start at the bottom, the second paragraph. You know, Greg is tough and durable. He has pitched over 235 innings in each of the past 5 years. He's the winningest pitcher in the NL over that period, with at least 15 victories every season. And of course, he would go on to have 15 victories over 19 seasons. A power pitcher, Greg mixes a hard slider with a sinking fastball and an outstanding changeup. More on that in just a little bit. So again, this isn't just the little one sentence or two sentence. You know, Greg pitched a three-hit shutout on such and such against the Houston Astros or whatever. This was a pretty detailed description of the player. Now, the downside to what Score did... Look at the first paragraph of the scouting report. Greg, who joins the Braves in 93. So wait a minute. So we've got Cub logo. We've got Cub hat in the picture. We've got Chicago Cubs front and back to this card. Yet we mention in the scouting report, by the way, he's with the Atlanta Braves. And that's where you could clearly see that the effort that once went into the Score brand was clearly kicked to the curb by this point in time. Pinnacle just had no effort in putting out the best card that they could put out. They put out an okay card, but they didn't put out the best card because, as you know, the signing of Greg Maddux was one of the biggest stories in baseball in the 1992-93 offseason. In fact, he had done so well in 1992 with the Cubs, a 20-game winner, his second All-Star appearance, his first Cy Young Award, and the Cubs were being cheap. They weren't going to pay him what he was worth, so he signed a big free agent deal with the Atlanta Braves. Of course, big at the time, 5 years, $28 million. Whew. How times have changed. That gets you your utility infielder these days. But, you know, that was such a huge story, and there was a big ramp up. There was no surprise that Greg Maddux was not going to be with the Cubs come 1993. So even though the Score set in 1993 was not released until March of that year, so Score had 4 months to, I don't know, at least slap a Braves logo on there. They didn't. They just left it as By the way, Greg Maddux is playing for the Braves now. So that really shows you how the standards at SCORE slipped so much. A company that was so innovative and so forward-looking in the late 80s, just 5 years later, is completely mailing it in. And especially with one of the biggest names and a player who would turn out to be one of the best pitchers, if not the best pitcher of the 1990s, moving forward. So I really think SCORE fails here. And that's what really brings this set down, because here you go. You have the National League Cy Young Award winner, and the card is already woefully outdated, even though, like I said, there were 4 months in between the time that Maddux signed with the Braves, and by the time that SCORE printed out a set here. So like I said, there wasn't a whole lot of excitement and promotion behind the SCORE set because Pinnacle wanted to put more of their efforts in pushing the Pinnacle brand and the SCORE Select brand. So 93 SCORE, if you bought some cards, and I didn't buy a whole lot, but if you bought some cards, they weren't really that outstanding. They looked nice, but they just didn't really match up to the competition. And much like a lot of the other brands, and I mentioned this in the Fleer Ultra podcast last time, the card companies, because they were producing so many cards, they were basically using the same template for other card sets. And I remember the 93-94 SCORE hockey sets, the exact same template here. So again, a set that looks nice, but is really just plain vanilla. That's the best way to put it. And they really could have added some chocolate chips and sprinkles to it and really made it work. But they just kept heaping on vanilla upon vanilla because they wanted to save all the condiments that went on top of the ice cream sundae for the other brands. So that's unfortunately a big swing and a miss for SCORE in 1993. Now, speaking of swings and misses, that definitely describes the career of Greg Maddux, the Mad Dog, where some people would call him the Professor. And again, you could argue that he was the best pitcher in the 1990s, or at least in the last generation of big league players. 355 wins, a 3.16 earned run average, 3,371 strikeouts. As I mentioned, 4 Cy Young Awards, in fact, consecutive Cy Young Awards from 92 through the 95 seasons. 8-time All-Star, 18 Gold Glove Awards. He was also a heck of a hitter, too. You know, people, you look at the pitching statistics for Greg Maddux. Well, he was a very good batter as well, as he had a career batting average of 171, which, you look at and you go, well, what's so big about 171? Well, considering most pitchers hit 071, that's actually not bad. And he actually had some power, too. He had 5 home runs in his career, 35 doubles, 2 triples as well. Drove in 84 runs in 1,812 plate appearances. So, you know, he kind of gets lost in all of the pitcher numbers, and rightfully so, because he was such a good hurler. You forget that he was not a liability at the plate like most pitchers in the National League are. So Greg Maddux was able to do some damage at both ends of the battery, mostly on the mound, but he certainly didn't hurt you when he was at bat. Now, a lot like some of the other stories that we've had recently, like Frank Thomas and Jim Thome, guys who were just completely passed over in the Major League Baseball draft, Greg Maddux was almost passed over. And in fact, his older brother, Mike Maddux, who of course would make it to the major leagues as well, a lot of attention was on Mike Maddux in the Maddux family in Las Vegas, in Nevada. His family settled there. He was an Air Force brat, by the way, Greg Maddux was. So the family settles into Las Vegas in the early 1980s. You have scouts coming out to watch Mike Maddux. And not jokingly, Greg Maddux's dad would say, hey, you're going to be coming back in a few years to watch this guy, you know, the younger kid. And Greg Maddux had a very special pitching instructor as he was growing up, Ralph Meter, former scout in the major leagues. And in a time, and this was especially true in the 80s, you know, everybody got caught up in the heat throwing of Roger Clemens and Doc Gooden, eventually, you know, Randy Johnson later on in the decade. Everyone was so mesmerized by the 98-mile-an-hour fastball that the artistics of pitching being able to mix in a backdoor slider, being able to mix in a curveball, and not just any old curveball, but one that would wickedly curve, you know, start high and in, but then drop down low and away, and you'd, you know, tie up batters in knots. That was starting to get left off the pitching charts. Everybody was just, you know, throw heat, pound it in. Well, Meador would go back to, you know, the artistry of pitching again, where he basically mentored Maddux into mixing up an effective array of pitches. And fortunately for Greg Maddux, he did that. So he graduates from Valley High School in Las Vegas. He is ready to go on into the major leagues. Mike Maddux drafted in 1982. So here we go. It's 1984. Greg Maddux is ready to go, but he doesn't have a whole lot of feelers from the major leagues. The colleges are overlooking him as well. So Greg Maddux was almost completely off the radar. Never mind under the radar, off the radar. Well, fortunately for the Chicago Cubs, a scout by the name of Doug Mapson saw his techniques, and even though Maddux was a very wiry kid, they thought, okay, we're going to go with a guy that's got a good array of pitches as opposed to the big, stocky, flame-throwing fastballer. So the Cubs took a chance with him in the second round of the 1984 amateur draft, and he goes up through their system and makes a very early major league debut. At the age of 20 in 1986, he is playing for the Chicago Cubs. Of course, the Cubs, not a very good team at the time. So he makes his debut on September 3rd, 1986. Now, a very interesting way that he makes his debut. This was, of course, before the days of lights at Wrigley Field. They wouldn't do that until the summer of 1988. So there was a game against the Houston Astros that went into the 17th inning. Well, darkness falls, so they have to call the game. And they decide, because it's a tie game, it's the 17th inning, they say, okay, we're going to conclude the game tomorrow. So Maddux makes his major league debut as a pinch runner in that 17th inning against the Astros. So then the next day, he is the pitcher. So he pitches the 18th inning, gives up a home run to Billy Hatcher, and he takes the loss. So welcome to the big leagues. You're a pitcher who is a pinch runner, and then the next day you show up for what is essentially the 18th inning of the game from the day before, and you give up the game-winning run, and that's that. Well, his first start, a complete game win. And then in his final start of the 86 season, this is a great story, he is going up against the Phillies. And who is pitching for the Phillies? Greg Maddux's older brother, Mike Maddux. So he not only beats Maddux, but he also pitches a complete game victory. So he one-ups his older brother, and of course, Mike Maddux is like, well, I knew he would do that. He always knew that Greg was a very competitive guy, and like I said, the patriarch of the Maddux family always knew that eventually Greg would supersede Mike in terms of accomplishments. So you had a hint of that when 20-year-old Greg Maddux one-ups his brother at the tail end of an otherwise forgettable 1986 season for the Chicago Cubs. Well, eventually, as the Cubs get better, so does Maddux. And in 1989, he is the starting pitcher and winning pitcher of the Cubs clincher in Montreal over the Expos. That's how the Cubs won the National League East. They, of course, would go on to face the Giants in the NLCS, and Maddux actually got pummeled in that playoff series, so the Giants move on to the World Series. But the world started really taking notice of Greg Maddux, and even though he was not a fireball, flame-throwing pitcher, he could dial up the heat. But he had so many tools in the tool belt, he always kept batters guessing, and more often than not, missing. Now, he was actually an all-star back in 1988 with an 18-8 season, but 1992 was the coming-out party. Like I said, an all-star there, 20-11, a 2.18 earned run average, and also the Cy Young Award winner that year. And famously gets into a shouting match. Well, not a literal shouting match, but he and his agent, Scott Boras, totally butting heads with the Chicago Cubs throughout the 92 season. The Cubs are not going to pay the big dollars it takes to keep Greg Maddux. So One of the legendary duh moves in the history of the Chicago Cubs happens at the end of the 1992 season, October 26, 1992. The Cubs let Greg Maddux walk. And who are some of the players that they try to spend money on to try to improve? Jose Guzman, Dan Plesac, and Candy Maldonado. Now, no offense to any of those players. They were very serviceable players. Dan Plesac would play what would seem like an eternity because he was a left-hander who was able to get just enough junk on the ball to get it over the plate. And Candy Maldonado, you know, me as a Blue Jay fan growing up, I would know he would help contribute to the Blue Jays later on to their World Series victories. But Jose Guzman, Dan Plesac, and Candy Maldonado combined are nowhere near the talent of Greg Maddux. And of course, Maddux signs with the Braves, and the rest, as they say, is history. In 1993, the Braves don't get to the World Series, but again, he wins the Cy Young, going 20-10 with a 2.36 earned run average. The strike shortened 94 season, Maddux went 16-6 with a 1.56 earned run average. Again, everyone laments the 94 season because that was the year, oh, the Expos could have done this, the Indians could have done that, the Yankees could have won the AL East. A lot of individual record-setting performances went by the wayside, including Greg Maddux. You know, the season ended on August 12th. How many wins? What kind of earned run average could he have posted had the 94 season been played to its completion? So even though it's a strike-shortened season, he still wins the Cy Young Award. And in 1995, it all comes together perfectly for Maddux. He goes 19-2, a 1.63 earned run average, and he wins the Cy Young Award as well. Now, he wouldn't win a Cy Young Award moving forward. However, he was a top five finalist for the 96 through 2000 seasons, with the exception of 1999. That was the one really off season that he had in his prime. And off for Greg Maddux meant 19-9 and a 3.57 earned run average, even though the Braves again won the pennant and went to the World Series once again, running into that buzzsaw known as the New York Yankees. And Maddux's career would continue to be very consistent and be extremely solid. But as the Braves started declining slowly in the late 90s and early 2000s, well, the band starts breaking up. Of course, Tom Glavin ends up with the Mets. Eventually, John Smoltz would end up with the Red Sox, but he was the last of the big three pitchers to go because Smoltz was going back and forth between the starting rotation and the bullpen. Well, Greg Maddux, they decide, the Atlanta Braves and Maddux camp come to an agreement on what he should be signed for. So at the end of the 2003 season, he walks. Well, the Chicago Cubs, trying to make amends for what happened in 1992, of course, the Cubs coming so close to going to the World Series in 2003, the infamous Steve Bartman play in the NLCS with the Florida Marlins, they decide, hey, even an older Greg Maddux is better than no Greg Maddux at all. So even though Maddux was 38 years old, they take a chance with him. And clearly Maddux's career is starting to slip a little bit here. But again, he's 38 years old, but he still gets 16 wins. His earned run average for the first time in his, the second time in his career, first time since 1987, goes up to 4.02. He's still delivering, but it's certainly not the Greg Maddux of just 5 or even 10 years before. Produces a 13-win season in 2005 for the Cubs, but it's his first sub-500 season since 1987. And now even the Cubs are a little wary of, exactly what can Greg Maddux do for you, as the Cubs' playoff hopes and World Series hopes are also sliding after that near miss in 2003. So in the middle of the 2006 season, he is traded to the Los Angeles Dodgers for Cesar Izturis, and the Dodgers are making a postseason run, and Maddux is trying to do that as well, as he went 6-3 with a 3.30 earned run average, and he contributed one start in the 2006 NLDS against the Mets, but got shelled, pitching just four innings, giving up four runs and 7 hits. At the end of the 2006 season, he decides to make a change once again, heading a little further south into San Diego. The Padres, kind of like the Cubs in 2004, hoping a little bit of that old Greg Maddux magic rubs off on them. But again, Maddux at the age of 41, granted, he got 14 wins that season, but he's not the 31-year-old Greg Maddux. He's doing good things, but not able to help the Padres keep their head above water. So midway through the 2008 season, the Padres let Greg Maddux go. They trade him to the Dodgers in exchange for Eduardo Perez, and that's the minor leaguer Eduardo Perez. Mike Witt, that's the minor leaguer Mike Witt, not the guy who once threw a no-hitter for the California Angels back in the 80s. But it's basically the Padres just dumping a big-name contract out. So one last chance for Maddux to try to do something in the postseason with the Dodgers. He struggles through the remainder of the regular season, but does pitch in relief for the Dodgers, not only in the NLDS against the Cubs, ironically, but also in the NLCS against the Phillies, who, of course, would go on to win the World Series. So once the 2008 season ended, he was granted free agency, didn't sign anywhere else, and a phenomenal career came to a close. Again, 355 wins to 227 losses, a 3.16 earned run average, 3,371 strikeouts to 999 walks. And that's really the most impressive number. It's always a telling story when you look at strikeout to walk ratio, and in Maddux's case, it's almost 3.5 to 1. But 999 walks, that is out over 5,008 1/3 innings. That is incredible. So you always look at the craftiness that Greg Maddux had as a pitcher. But when you see just 999 walks, over 5,000 innings pitched, over 744 games, over a 23-year career, that is just absolutely amazing. And throughout his career, you know, his strikeout to walk ratio was 154 to 46. That's the number, not the actual ratio. The ratio would then come out to about 3 to 1. So if you're wondering, where is Greg Maddux these days? He is very much still involved in baseball. In fact, he is the assistant coach at UNLV in Las Vegas. He has been the pitching coach for UNLV. And what do you know? Greg's son, Chase, is a pitcher at UNLV. So he certainly has quite the mentor there on the coaching staff. Also, he is a special assistant for the Los Angeles Dodgers, special assistant to the president of baseball operations, Andrew Friedman, of course. We know him well here in Tampa Bay, the former general manager of the Rays from 2006 through 2014. So again, you know, Greg Maddux, there's no doubt what his career, what he was able to accomplish, all the positive things that he did in his career. But something I do want to bring up quickly, and again, this goes back to a conversation we had in the 86 Tops podcast with Jack Morris. You know, Jack Morris had an incredible number of complete games, not just season to season, but in his career. And I said back on that podcast, I said, you know, with the specialization of bullpens and pitching staffs these days, I think the day of having, you know, 12 complete games, 24 complete games, you know, the numbers that Morris put up on a regular basis, and not just Morris, I mean, Morris would have 20 complete games in a season, and he didn't lead the majors in that category. I said, those days are long gone because of the specialization. You just have starters who, once they hit a certain pitch count, or as soon as the seventh inning comes around, depending on the manager or the pitching staff, or the pitching coach, I should say, they're more often than not, they're pulled from action, and that's that. Well, I think with Maddux, you know, Maddux may be one of the last 300-game pitchers that we see, at least in this generation. As I mentioned, he had 355 wins in his career. As if that's not impressive, you know, hitting 300 games is amazing, but to be able to pile on 55 more over the course of a 23-year career, I mean, that's just amazing. But seeing pitchers get across the 300-win line, I don't know if that's going to happen. Now, going into this upcoming season, your wins leader right now is Bartolo Colon, but he's 43 years old. He has 233 wins, and he's with the Braves. So, you know, the Braves now aren't exactly the Braves of Greg Maddux's time. So I doubt that Bartolo Colon, even though he's done some amazing things, especially with a bat in the last couple of years, I doubt that 43-year-old Bartolo Colon is going to find a way to muscle 67 wins in the remainder of his career, because he probably has one, maybe two seasons left. And I, like I said, I doubt the Braves are going to be able to win 67 games over those two seasons for Bart Cologne, or even in this season in general. Now, the next player, who is much more spry compared to Bartolo Colon, he's about as big, though, CeCe Sabathia. He's 35. He has 223 wins. Now, with the Yankees, it is possible. Now, you go a little further on down the line, Justin Verlander, who's 33, well, he has 173 wins, so even he has a long way to go. You look at some of the younger pitchers, Felix Hernandez, 30 years old, but 154 wins, so he still has a way to go. Let me see who else. I'm looking at around 30. Clayton Kershaw, here we go, great example. Clayton Kershaw, 28 years old, 126 wins. So Clayton Kershaw would have to, with the Dodgers or wherever he ends up later on in his career, would need 174 wins over the next 10 to 12 years of his career. Is it possible? Well, with a pitcher like Kershaw, absolutely. If he stays with the Dodgers for most of that time, he sure could. Even David Price at the age of 30, 121 wins, you know, if he's able to stay with a successful team like the Red Sox, perhaps if he plays until he's 42, he can hit 300. But you can see, and by the way, I'm getting down now to like number 20 in the list of current wins here. You can see once you look at the players who are in their early 30s or close to 30, even it's a long stretch for them. So Sabathia might. Guys like Hernandez, Kershaw, and Price could. I think Kershaw, of all those players that I named, will have the best chance, and mostly because he's the youngest. And of course, he's, you could argue, the most talented of all those, and he's on the best team. So he probably has the best chance over the next 10 to 12 years to do that. But in Greg Maddux, we probably saw the last of the 300-game winners. And I don't mean like the final, you know, I shouldn't say the last, but certainly in this generation, I don't think you're going to see too many 300-game winners. Because again, a lot of these pitchers, they're getting pulled, you know, going into the seventh inning now. And you know, if a game, you know, gets decided later than the seventh inning, these pitchers, they aren't getting credited with the win. So even the 300 win stat, which again used to be the big stat for pitchers, once they hit 300 wins, they were automatic for the Hall of Fame. Even that's not definite anymore. And that just goes to show you how much the game has changed over the years. Well, not much changed with Greg Maddux as a pitcher and as a person, and an outstanding player for mostly the Atlanta Braves, but again, the Cubs and the Dodgers and the Padres during a phenomenal 23-year career. Our random pull from our 93 score setting card number 576. So let us know your thoughts about the Mad Dog, Greg Maddux, or the Professor, as some people called him. The lackluster 93 score setter. Anything else on your mind by commenting on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gumstains. All right, only a couple more sets in 1993. We're going to do them in this order. Upper Deck will be next. That was the set that set the bar, but could they keep up with the competition in 1993? And then we'll take a look at Tops. So Upper Deck coming your way on Friday, as well as the results of our listener poll. And 93 Tops will round out our big old monster box a week from today. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to Wax Ecstatic